to What's the Mood, where we talk all things mood and mindset, sleep, nutrition, chemical health, and leadership. I'm your host, Julie Berry, from the Illinois Human Performance Project, and we are so glad you're here.
Today, we are in for a real treat as we have John Underwood with us. John is the founder of the Human Performance Project, which is a nationally recognized program. It consists of 30 years of human performance research. John has partnered with veteran Navy SEALs of applied performance science. He has devoted so much of his life to the message of healthy choices and positive leadership, and believes in the power of holding students and one another accountable to decisions that lead to optimal performance. John, welcome to What's the Mood.
We're going to dive right back in part two here because part one was so good. You mentioned in the first one that you have written a new book. Tell us a little bit about like the highlight reel of that, or why did you even step into doing such a thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. interestingly, you know, to have spent so much time in human performance, and my end of it was physiology, so muscles, heart, lungs, capacities, training and recovery and planning of training and periodization, it's called, and peaking, you know, how do you get a quantum leap in performance when the most important stuff comes? And so after all those years of doing that with high level sport and then other assignments and projects, you know, some new concepts came out. And I'll talk about Tim Noakes often because it was such, it debunked so many things that had been assumed for so long, that there's this connection between mental and physical performance that's what makes it happen. And if you don't take that into consideration, something happens, but not probably what could happen. And if you look at performance potential versus performance actualization, is what I call it, like what's your actual ability to perform at a certain level on a given day at a given time. And even that can be corrupted by things like stress and lack of preparation and mood and mindset and so many other factors. And so I started to say, how could we separate mental and physical if we're talking about performance? There's an absolute deep connection between mental and physical systems. And once they started to realize that it's not, these systems don't just run physiologically by themselves. The brain is running them. The brain is monitoring them. And even something as simple as the fact that if you doubt yourself, or you don't have a proper mood, nothing great's going to happen. And it's no different. And I use this as an example because I'm not just talking about athletes here. I'm talking about performance. You're standing and you have to give a speech or a recital or a music or art or dance or anything. And the curtain's about to open and you're standing there and you're so freaked out that all that's running through your mind is, oh my God, I hope I don't screw this up. You're going to screw it up. And the reason is the connections between your brain and your body systems, it's ongoing. And if you don't have this deep connection, which, you know, a lot of times if we really want to examine where that is, when people have an ultimate performance, they call it the zone. I didn't make any mistakes. It was like autopilot. This thing was just going by itself. I don't know what happened. I don't know how I ran this time or, you know, played this music without a single mistake. It was like I didn't even have to try. All these zones come into synchronization and all these different capacities, and some are mental and some are physical. So as I started to write this thing, I'm going like, I'm going to write this book about training and recovery. There's millions of books like that. Where are the books about this connection between mental and physical to be able to perform? So anyway, the capsule summary is this. I took my 43 years of experience, things I had learned about getting past where you are physically and mentally, And I started to realize these things go hand in hand. There isn't some, like, there's not a channel for mental and a channel for physical. The channel is one channel. And so as I delved into it, I started to think, okay, what things could we help people understand so that they would have the information to assess their readiness to perform based on mental and physical? Okay, you know, physical, all right, we know you have to be hydrated. We know you have to have blood glucose because your muscles and actually your brain too run off your blood sugar levels, your blood glucose levels. So you have to have that. You have to be rested, right? You can't be tired and physically exhausted. If muscles tired, if heart and lungs are tired, respiration, cardiac output, all those things can be not in a state of recovery status so that you can't perform because maybe you trained too hard a couple of days before or whatever. Brain's the same way. You know, all the stuff that, you know, we have espoused with central nervous system readiness, topped off neurotransmitter levels, sleep. So all those different things together create this checklist, or like, you know, like sensors. Certainly our body has a system of sensors. I always tell people, when you go out to start your car in the morning, what if you turned your key and every light on the dashboard went on? Would you drive it? Or would you go like, wow, something's wrong with my car? We don't have sensors like that, but we do. And the interesting thing is that if you listen to your body and you listen to your systems will give you feedback, plenty of feedback. And so I started to realize that, my God, so many people don't know these things. And in the context of, I'm gonna say like high school and college age athletes, which for me, or even I'll say this, middle school, high school, and college age athletes, there's a gigantic void of information on how to mentally prepare and how important that connection is between mental and physical.
What book sounds awesome and timely in our day and age. What's a piece of information or a data point that you're like, this is majorly missing to that age group of athletes and performers?
Well, you know, we've connected this to, all right, stress, right? I mean, there's stress. There has to be a certain amount of stress or you can't perform. I mean, people, I think everyone realizes, all right, if you're going to go do something and it's really important and you want to go out there and smack the home run or, you know, have a great race or run the fastest time or, you know, do an amazing performance, I think you have to realize that, you know, a certain amount of stress is going to enter the picture. If you're going to have stress, you're going to have to deal with it. And the unfortunate part is most people just don't get past, you know, figuring out a system to deal with stress. I'll give you an example. When you look at the release of these hormones or stress hormones, like everybody's been nervous to a point where you get a little shaky and you start to sweat, or maybe you start to breathe faster, your heart rate races, you start feeling anxiety and you start flipping out a little bit. Well, in most cases, you've already released hormones into your bloodstream. And once those hormones are released, you're past the point of no return. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so what if we could figure out how to give people usable skills to deal with stress? I mean, I think everyone now at least has heard something about mindfulness and breathing patterns. And, you know, I'm later today, I'm going across the ice. You know, if I fall through the ice, I'm, you know, the first thing you got to do is you got to breathe. You know, because you hold your breath and your systems all lock up and you drop hormones and you know, once those, you know, those hormones like norepinephrine and so forth hit your system, you know, it can be a horrible impact on your body. So, you know, you figure out a way to deal with stress. I'm not sure a lot of people understand stress. There's a certain amount of stress required to be able to perform. It can be healthy or unhealthy. You can reach a point where it becomes toxic. You know, I mean, I look at like people who have daily stress in their lives. look at relationship stress. Some kids at this age, right? Boyfriend, girlfriend stress, job stress. I mean, look at how people handle job stress. I mean, if you're so stressed at your workplace that it makes you ill, physically ill, you need to either figure out how to deal with it or you need to find a different place to be. You know, I mean, and like most people aren't able to do that, whether they're bought in too much or they need the money or they get caught up in, I can't do anything about this. You can do something about it. But the best way to learn these strategies to deal with stress are at a young age. And I just don't think that we, you know, I don't think we've spent in our society enough time, effort, and energy on helping people understand health. Yeah. I mean, health, I went to college undergrad to be a health educator. That's it. That's all I wanted to be. I wanted to be a health teacher. And I'll tell you why. I had a great high school health teacher. And when I took health, he said, God, this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And man, I sure did a giant curve, you know, to end up doing what I did. Mm-hmm. But what am I now? Basically, I'm teaching people how to take a healthier approach to maximize their potential mm-hmm. in whatever they want to do. And so understanding stress is the first part. And mm-hmm. secondly is to develop abilities to deal with stress, you know, fears and doubts and anxiety and negative mood and mindset. I mean, going into a situation where all you can think of is, oh my God, I hope I don't screw this up, or we're going to get killed today in a football game or basketball game, or mm-hmm. I don't belong here because these guys are so good. Or you suddenly find yourself when you make it to state and you're happy enough that you made it to state that you don't care what's going to happen once you get there. Mm-hmm. You know, there, that's got more to do with level of expectation. So we took all these topics, okay, say fear, doubt, precursors. The precursor to fear is doubt. The precursor to doubt is fear, right? I'm afraid. You know why you're afraid? Usually you're not prepared, right? I mean, if you think about studying for a big test and you go into the test going like, I'm going to ace this thing. I got this. I know this stuff. That helps you go in and do it. And it's no different when you're an athlete and you go, oh my God, this is it. It's mm-hmm. my time to shine. I did everything possible to make mm-hmm. this happen. And I can be, I'm confident that I can go out and do this thing. Mm-hmm. There you go.
But, yeah, but here's what I feel like I'm hearing you say is like, there's a gap with this age group of students where like we can do a better job of teaching them what a healthy relationship with their fears and stress mm-hmm. looks like. Otherwise, mm-hmm. that stress and that fear, because it's going to come, overpowers them and they don't know what to do or how to handle it.
Yeah, exactly. Even since the initial sensations of anxiety, I mean, like holding your breath or tightness mm-hmm. or, you know, just tenseness, you know, being all tensed up or sweating or your hands sweat or you start tapping and shaking and, you know, there's so many different things. And, you know, some people actually just to take a test, it's not healthy the way it's being done. Mm-hmm. It's pressure. And then there's parental pressure and there's,
societal ownership. Pressure.
Yeah. Ownership of a young kid's project, their career. I got a grandson right now in youth hockey over in Vermont. And, you know, it's got some great things about it. It's got some nasty things about it. And it's got a whole bunch of parents that are, you know, hell bent on their kid making it to the NHL. And it's comical. I'm going to see him play this weekend here. He's coming over to New York to play a game. But, you know, I also think that you get to a situation where we have the ability to educate parents too. Mm-hmm. And we've done a really crappy job of that. All right, think of this. If I'm going in to do substance abuse education with kids and tell them, here's a whole bunch of things that are not real good about weed and alcohol and getting caught up in use of substances, even caffeine, nicotine, all those things that we've put out information on. Well, you know, that's great. They got that soundbite from us. but they don't live with us. And maybe back in the home, they're with a parent who smokes weed right in front of them, gets drunk in the, every night in front of them, I'll give you an example. Look how many kids are basically pre-addicted to nicotine based on the fact that they're exposed to it. I remember that landmark study they had, they took babies, who lived with a smoker, and they took urine from babies' diapers, and the diapers or the urine that they just squeezed out of diapers and analyzed had enough nicotine to get you addicted to nicotine. Really great thing to do to your kid. But sound bites for kids as they reach impressionable age, which for me is now fourth, fifth, sixth grade, impressionable age, they can start to think about the way they want to live their life, or maybe what they want to do or what they're good at. And where are the sound bites for like eating healthy, sleeping, dealing with stress? We're going to have to deal with stress. Where do we help kids deal with stress? When they finally have to go see a professional? I mean, it's like you can't fix some things that you let go too far. And that's an issue too. So I decided that, rather than just have a book that's, is your head on straight? Do you have central nervous system readiness? How are you going to deal with the stress that's going to come when you go to do this thing? Mm-hmm. I realized, we had to go deeper than that, and we had to explain some things that people really don't have any clue about. And I was just looking this morning. We got hooked up really early with a research from HeartMath Institute. It's very few people know about it. And, in our last podcast, I talked about HRV. This your heart has this amazing system where you can see everything about what's going on with a person's health, stress, sleep, nutrient deficiencies or adequacies from their HRV. You can see if somebody's drank alcohol, weed, done drugs, stimulants, anything. And so anyway, HeartMath Institute has been going on for a long time. It's brilliant stuff. That just hear this one soundbite, which, I mentioned in here. I don't get deep into it because it's technical. But like, where are neurons, right? Neurons are in your brain, right? We have, I don't know, hundreds of millions of neurons in a human brain. All these connections between those brain cells. But interestingly, HeartMath Institute, did research and found that there's about 40,000 sensory neurons in your heart. What are they doing in your heart? Well, here's the interesting part. And this is where HRV comes into the picture, which is an amazing technological just breakthrough, is that these neurons, which are called neurites, about 40,000 in your heart, they actually are sensors. They can sense hormone levels in your blood. All right, so, cortisol is this main stress hormone that releases, where that's what makes you get shaky, right? So once I said the hormones hit your system, it's too late, right? It's already in your bloodstream. And whether that's, fight or flight, epinephrine, norepinephrine, cortisol, all these hormones, once they're released, it just starts shutting down your ability to perform. It's no different than, you're working with Navy SEALs and they're in all of a sudden there's bullets flying everywhere. And you freak out and you just curl up in a ball, right? You have to figure out a way that you bypass all this sudden stress, the unknown, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And even if it's something that we know, right? So, on this date is state wrestling finals and I got to go out there and take a shot at winning it. The date, you had all this time to prepare a whole season. Now the day is here. Just like there's unknown stress, right? It's going to just, it comes out of nowhere. So those are some of the things that, you would have this situation where, if those hormones hit your bloodstream, they're detectable. It shows up in measurements that we can make. And so we start to help people realize that there's amazing body systems that give you feedback. Just like I was talking about the sensors on your dashboard for your car. Mm-hmm. We can measure all those things. And even though that the average person's never going to have those things measured, you can learn from what we know about the measurements, right? How much of a dent it puts in your performance potential if these things are not where they should be. Any more than if these things aren't topped off, like your neurotransmitter levels. If your neurotransmitter levels are not topped off, your mood and mindset swings towards the dark side. It swings towards the negative side where, mm-hmm. you know, you start to think, oh my God, I hope I don't screw this up. Or you think, I don't belong here. I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm sure there's been kids who have a chance to get in a game sometimes against a real good team. And they think to themselves, I hope coach doesn't put me in. Then what are you doing? Right. Well, I mean, what if you left these abilities to deal with a stressful situation mm-hmm. Undealt with to a point where now if you are thrown into the mix, you're going to fail. It's not like the clouds are going to part and sunbeams are going to come down. And it's that, you know, that's like a Disney movie and, you know, you win the championship. No, you have to have this connection between mental and physical. Mm-hmm. And I added a lot about science. I talked about, you know, when we were working with the SEALs, there was some research done on their brain chemistry. And all right, so if you're stressed, what makes you, after you're stressed, go back to some level of normalcy, right? So, I mean, you have a traumatic event. Let's say you have a traumatic event. Someone screams at you. The day of the state championships and you find out your parents are splitting up, or your girlfriend dumps you, your boyfriend dumps you, as a teenager at that age, emotions can be very deep, and mm-hmm. you haven't figured out yet at the same time how deep emotional changes can derail you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, I mean, we wrote into our program through work we had seen with some of the Canadian athletes, and in particular this fantastic sports psychologist, Terry Orlick, full mental focus, distraction control, focus, refocus. What if it doesn't go the way you planned? Mm-hmm. You know, it's the first quarter and you're down by four touchdowns. I mean, you know, somebody you were supposed to go out and thump in performance is, you know, beating the heck out of you. Positive outlook. You know, I mean, like, it all starts there. It all begins and ends in the brain. So I went from physiology to psychology, but only across the channels of experiential. My coaching, my work with Olympic athletes, which I did for several decades and beyond, professional teams and Navy SEALs and top level performers, and said, like, okay, so these guys must have figured this stuff out because they couldn't be as good as they are if mm-hmm. they didn't have all these fail-safe systems or firewalls. I mean, I talk about firewalls with stress. You know, how can you build a firewall so that, like, this thing can't get to the level that it derails your performance?
And, can you define what you mean by firewall?
A skill or an ability to prevent stress from crossing over into the impact it will have on your physiological systems and the outcomes. I mean, if you're freaked out, you know, there's a little bit of anxiety that is healthy mm-hmm. when you're going to go perform. I mean, I was going to say this before I started to. If you're going to go into a performance and you're like yawning and, you know, you're almost falling asleep, you ain't ready to perform. I mean, come on, maybe you'll be asleep on the field. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to get excited enough physically mm-hmm. and physiologically, right? That's why we warm up and like activate our muscles and our muscle groups and everything. But, you know, you got to do the same thing for your brain. What if you get too excited? right? You're so sky high jacked psychologically that, you know, these other things start to, you know, decay and fall apart. Mm-hmm. Like full mental focus might go from like, you're totally focused to now there's distractions. You know, I mean, when you're out there performing, you know, I'm saying like, you're like, it's like you're in this tunnel. You're in a tunnel. So, you know, I think that's a pretty good description, but I said, if I had to say like, what's this mental performance guide about, I'll tell you in the first paragraph, is your head on straight? Do you have CNS readiness? How will you deal with stress from this big event that's upcoming? Are you mentally ready to perform at your best? These are questions about mental preparation for optimal performance that often go unanswered until the curtain opens or the starter's pistol sounds, or you run out on the court. And there, the second aspect of it is it healthy? Because if something is, you can do all those things, but it's not healthy.
Great question.
It's going to come unraveled at some point in time.
Yeah.
So
that's excellent. So this sounds awesome. And again, so timely, like from a practical standpoint, what's your hope for this mental performance, like wellness guide? What do you hope to see happen with it?
I think there's such a void, and it's not just the taboo of asking for help when you're going through some rough times. I mean, in the last few years, when I look at Michaela Schifrin, the greatest skier that's ever put on a pair of skis, and her father dies, and it totally derails her, what she could have done in the Olympics. Simone Biles, greatest gymnast that's ever flipped, right? I mean, she ended up with a bronze medal when she's got, I don't know how many dozens of gold medals she's gotten, worlds and Olympics. It can take down anybody at any time. You think those people are not strong? They've already done it. Michael Phelps, 24 gold medals. I don't know. He had incredible stress and traumas and existing trauma over long periods of time, substance use, substance abuse. And, you know, at the end of his career, he starts swimming times almost as fast as he swam when he was in his best years. It's not done. It's not possible. But it just shows you how much better he would have been. The greatest living Olympian, greatest Olympian there's ever been as far as results. If this can take the wheels off their bus, what can it do for you? You know, you have to start to think. I have to figure out where I am in this puzzle. And if you're missing all those pieces of the puzzle that are the ones for mental prep, so think about this: pre-performance preparation, okay, and then during performance preparation, or like what? All right, so before you even compete, what do we know that you have to have checked off on the, you know, check these boxes? Any more than you've got them for physical performance, right? I've got to have fuels in my muscles. They got to be totally loaded with glycogen, so I can last through this whole race or this whole competition. I've got to be hydrated. At halftime, I have to rehydrate. I got to get my blood glucose levels up and maintain them like a wave, right? I can't drink anything too sweet. I can't have low blood sugar. I have to be rested, right? Physically rested. And then you start saying, okay, I have the same things, as far as the brain, but mood and mindset, where is this talked about? How about a coach hears his team going like, oh my God, we're going to get killed today. You think that's not going to impact other kids who hear somebody even say those words? So I talk about, okay, well then here's how you confront it. You bring the kid aside. You go, hey, come here. What did I just hear you say? Are you serious? This is going to spread through the whole group here, dude. You can't talk like that. You know, you're ruining our chances before we even go out there to do what we're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And you know, you think about the impact an older athlete, maybe a starter, can have on somebody who's a younger athlete who hasn't been on the big stage. But like communication, cooperation, problem solving. I mean, these are the things that come into the equation. But it starts with understanding. All right. So if we first explain to people, you know, everybody's been stressed. I mean, when I used to talk to kids about stress, I'd say, okay, like, tell me some symptoms of when you really, where you've been in a really stressful situation. And they're always the same, you know, it's not rocket science. And then you say, okay, well, and you know, here's what was happening. You explain it to them. Your mm-hmm. body dumped these stress hormones, and you know, it's to protect you, or to, you know, it's to engage you so that you can deal with stress. It's just like fight or flight, right? You drop the hormones, and you know, you feel like you're armed. You know, you feel like, okay, I, this might not be good. This might be a life threatening situation here. Mm-hmm. But you can have it go over the top and spill over into a lot of positive things that you could have, you know, controlled. You know, it's no different than saying, you know, if you have a bad thing happen to you physically, an injury or something, and you're in a bad place and there's no way out of there, like, you know, remaining calm, thinking, not reacting. And a lot of those same things are taught to performance capacities are taught to people that are in lines of work where, you know, it's life threatening, you know, firefighters. And, you know, people make mistakes when they react instead of think. You know, I mean, that's, they always say, you know, you know, same thing, like look at people who get too excited too early or too excited too late, and it's too late. Sorry. So we did one on dialing up and dialing down and decompensating. So, I mean, look at how many kids do multiple competitions. You know, you play two or three games, or you wrestle two or three matches, or you run two or three races. What do you do in between? Mm-hmm. How about somebody where they go out for their first race and they do terrible, and they come out, they get done with it, and they're all like angry and you know, they start with "I suck" and "Oh my God, I'm so embarrassed," right?
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen when you go out for race number two and race number three? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, why do we have timeouts in sport? Do you ever think about that? Why? Why is there timeouts? Why does each team get this number of timeouts? It's bizarre. Why doesn't the game just start and the game plays out? Why is there timeouts? It's because if something's not going well, you can take a timeout and you can say, okay, let's look, guys, let's focus, refocus here. This is going on. This has got to change. You got to get on this. You got to get on that. Well, you know, some of these timeouts can happen, you know, with yourself, you know, and you got to figure it out because you don't have a lot of time. So anyway, that's part of it. We added in all the brain science stuff, the brain scans, neurotransmitter scans. You know, one of the coolest things I think is we described stress. We connected all these things to sleep, which is huge. Mm-hmm. I've got, you know, I mean, I got that letter from when I went to Alabama, and I showed stuff on, you know, sleep surveys we did with college athletes and how mood and mindset's affected by sleep and everything. And I got a nice letter from Coach Saban talking about how after I left, they started a sleep assessment study and found a whole bunch of guys weren't sleeping enough. And, you know, I mean, they're in college. Okay, well, that's probably they're not sleeping a lot. Mm-hmm. We got brain scans of, you know, normal brain scans, calm, stressed, and panic level, and PTSD, which is past panic. I mean, that's pretty cool to see. Actual brain scans. So it's sort of cool because you're not just trying to help people understand the tolerance to stress and that it reaches a dangerous point. You're trying to have people realize that before I get to that level, there's a whole bunch of things I could have done. That's what I'm talking about with firewalls is skills that you could, I mean, even like sometimes, like, you know, if you're stressed, like you start making fists and your breathing pattern changes and you hold your breath. Your heart feels like it's beating out of your chest. I mean, right there, there's some whole bunch of sensors going off. Mm-hmm. But also to have people understand that the goal is not to see how much stress you can accumulate or stand but to reduce it as much as possible so that you can perform at your best. I think, you know, stress tolerance, stress inoculation, they've tried those things. You know, there were studies done on seals at Buds where, I mean, they're physically, mentally, emotionally trashing you. Some of the toughest people just don't make it because it's not about who can tolerate the most stress. Do most people even, I said this the other day, when I was talking to the head of a state athletic association for high school athletics, I said, what's the weakest part of coaches' education? And he really didn't have an answer. He didn't know what I was talking about. And I was giving him a foresight about our work right now. And I started this right when COVID started, so I had plenty of time on my hands. I said, it's mental preparation. I said, who's got a sports psychologist working with their team? I go to colleges. I go to Division I major colleges that don't have a sports psychologist working with their team. So who's the sports psychologist? The coaches, or you are, right? For yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has failed. Everyone has had a disappointing performance where you almost embarrassed yourself. I think back to I ran 1,000 races in 32 years. It's a lot of races. Mm-hmm. And I know there are a couple times where it was a big race and I absolutely just choked.
Yeah.
And then there were races where I came through and it went unbelievable and I was in the zone and I don't remember a thing about it. And I wrote some stuff about that personal in the book too. But like, mm-hmm. there's so many times that you will fail because these things are left unchecked. The boxes aren't checked off. You know, the one time they launched the space shuttle, when there was something wrong with it, what happened? Look up the story. The thing blew up and everybody was killed. Mm-hmm. And they knew something was wrong before they launched it, and they launched it anyway. Bad mistake. Yeah. All systems go. That's what it's got to be. All systems go, and if all systems aren't go, you don't launch it. Sorry. How about this too? When you're physically tired and exhausted and physically traumatized or stressed, what's going on with your brain? It's the same.
Mm-hmm.
Status of recovery
mm-hmm.
is going on in your muscles, your heart, your lungs, and your brain simultaneously. So what if the muscles, heart, and lungs are ready to perform, mm-hmm. but the brain is still not recovered? You can't mm-hmm. perform. It ain't going to happen. It's no one's going to do their best they've ever done when under those circumstances. So
you're right. Yeah. You're making me think like, when I was in, oh dear, maybe like sixth grade, I was playing travel soccer and I quit the team halfway through. And I psychologically have lived a lot of my life believing I'm a quitter until I have reprogrammed. No, I'm not. I finish things. I can finish things to the end. I don't quit. Like 40-year-old woman, that's how mm-hmm. long it's taken me on the psychological front to shift a mindset from mm-hmm. an experience that programmed in my brain.
Oh yeah. I mean, seriously, that was a decision, right? And mm-hmm. and it's you may say it haunts you or whatever. There's also things like, think how many people have had early childhood trauma. You don't just one day wake up and you go like, hey, that's all in the past now. No, it sticks. It's in your amygdala, the primitive part of the brain that chronicles, you know, horrible events, and it's there forever. And you're not really ever going to ditch it, but you figure ways to come out to grips with it. That's clinical. That's like, you got to go see somebody. You got to figure this out. You got to figure out skills and abilities to take you past it. Mm-hmm. Because it resurfaces and it resurfaces. Well, the same thing happens when a kid has a really bad performance experience.
Mm-hmm.
It resurfaces. It resurfaces. Yeah. And when you look at that age of brain development, the most pivotal, age 12 to 21, when you're transitioning from you're transitioning from young adulthood to adulthood, mm-hmm. right? And you're starting to make your own decisions and choices, and you could make some good decisions or bad decisions or good choices or bad choices. We all have. Your brain is highly susceptible to trauma. Your brain is highly susceptible to addiction mm-hmm. at that age. Mm-hmm. Probably more so than any other window of time we could look at. We know that early childhood trauma is, it's a horrible thing. But if you guys looked at some studies that were done in Great Britain on Olympic champions, not Olympic medalists, not Olympic, you know, people who made it to the Olympics, not people who made it to the Olympic trials, champions, the gold medalists, one of the single biggest connective factors in all those Olympic medalists was early childhood trauma. Go figure on that one. And you know what? You know why? Because they got past the early childhood trauma and it developed in them resiliency.
Yeah.
So that these people would not quit until they got what they wanted. Okay. So, I mean, you look at, you know, somebody who's had some, at a very, very young age has gotten past some horrible, horrible thing that happened. It can be an incredible asset, just as it can be an incredible anchor around your neck, sinking you yeah. the rest of your life. Right. So, I mean, you said yeah. this, coming to grips with something that
yeah.
didn't go the way you wanted it to go. And it can be deep, very deep. And
it can define you or it can fuel you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I remember once we put out that a poster and it was a saying, it isn't any, I don't know the source of it. It's no one's names on it, but it was like, you have the choice at any time to say, this is not the way this thing ends. All right. So, I mean, I love that saying because I've seen people that were in really bad place and mm-hmm. they snapped out of it and they came back and they recouped their life or they, and I've seen some people keep right going down, the downward spiral. I told that story before of I was talking to an NBA team and it was in the D League, which is, you know, if you leave the NBA, they have the D League Development League, but very few people ever go down to the D League and make it back to the NBA. It's just too competitive. And this guy was an unbelievable college player and he basically drugged and drank himself out of the NBA. And he was now playing for a D-League team, and he was way past his best years. And I spoke to those guys, and he said, after he said, can I talk to you? And I said, yeah. And he said, man, he sat there, and he said, man, I blew it, didn't I? What was I supposed to say? I'm like, I know how many guys make it back to the NBA from the D-League. I just didn't say anything. And then he got tears in his eyes. This is the kind of stuff I remember out of all my years I did my work. And he got tears in his eyes, and he said, I just fell in with the wrong guys. I've never forgotten that because to a great extent, that is the catalyst. Is that if you're hanging around with a whole bunch of people doing that stuff, there's going to be some people that crash all the way to the bottom. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter how skilled or talented you were because he was. And he's never, ever, he never got to his full potential because he... a choice he made, a decision he made. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think of some other things. I think of kids that wrote me letters saying I was in way over my head and I see it now. And I'm going to take the time I got left in my career to, you know, to see if I can get back on the right page. I'll just tell you a couple other things that are in here. Just so maybe we can talk about these things. If like dialing up and dialing down, I mean, you can't, 7 o'clock in the morning, you're leaving on a trip to go run a race or play a game and the game's at 1 o'clock and you're already sky high. No, you have to control yourself so that emotionally you're not using up all your neural energy. And mm-hmm. then by the time the game starts, you have mm-hmm. none to use for the game. You know, dialing down is that in between rounds or halftime or timeouts or when you come off the field, you dial down. So you can conserve energy. You know, the brain is actually made to conserve energy, not to release it. and use it up. So even that, to some extent, when you're going out and you're going to run the mile and it's your, or you're going to run the 400 meters and you want to run your fastest time ever. You want to break 50 seconds in high school, a good time, or 48 seconds in college, or 45 or whatever. And you say, okay, I have to now use up all my energy in 45 seconds. Are you kidding me? Because your body doesn't want to do that. Your body doesn't want to use up that much reserves. Mm-hmm. The brain is geared to conserve energy, not release it and combust it. So, mm-hmm. So, you know, we talk about that too, but we talk about from HeartMath, a lot of the stuff on originally with breathing, how these breathing patterns were developed so that you could calm yourself, and the science of it. Your respiration, like when you slow down your breathing, your heart rate slows down. Okay. Mm-hmm. And as you get control of your respiration and your cardiac system, stress starts to diminish. All right. So, I mean, you look at people who learn breathing exercises, and that's everything from people who are going into labor to have a baby to, guys in the trenches in a war zone. It's huge. And you know, what is the zone? Everybody talks about the zone. I can tell you what the zone is. Here's my definition in my book of the zone. I just flipped a page and here it is on page 80, 81. You experience a state of flow of consciousness and physiological synergy between the brain and the body that amplified performance beyond your normal levels. That's it right there. It's like it puts you in synchronization so that all your systems, it's like the planets all come into alignment. Well, here it is, guys. All of your systems come into full focus so that everything goes into this thing you're doing. And when it's over, you're shaking your head going, I can't believe I did this, right? And it happens. It happens a few times in your life. So so I really describe in here this whole thing with, it's called coherence. All right, you think of synergy. Well, coherence is the same thing. The state when the heart, mind, and emotions are in energetic alignment and cooperation. State that builds resiliency, personal energy is accumulated, not wasted, leaving more energy to manifest intentions and outcomes. Whoa, Nelly. That could really help you, right?
I'm just like picturing the whole world in the coherent zone and how much greater that would be.
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't it be neat? Wouldn't it be neat if everyone was thinking good thoughts and thinking of the synergy of like mankind, like, you know, caring, really caring about everybody. And, I describe in here like different breathing patterns, 4-7-8 breathing and so forth, you know, stuff that I learned with the guys in the, special ops and, thinking like you can do a workshop on it. We used to out in California, the Donnell Campbell's amazing program out there, Athlete Committed. We would have a yearly training, and I always had to workshop with the breathing stuff, and the kids would all lay on the floor, and it was after lunch, and a lot of kids would start doing it and they would fall asleep. So, I mean, if you can put teenagers to sleep right after lunch, and I'm talking like really healthy, these kids are all handpicked to be at a leadership training, and here's these kids laying on the floor and we have to go over and like, ooh, come on, guy, you gotta wake up now. They would fall asleep during a breathing workshop, and, which is pretty cool,
Yeah.
But let me also throw in this one. There's got to be some, and I put in a huge chapter here on substance. Why do people turn to substances? Well, it's a no brainer. Not in a good way, but in a bad way. To deal with their stress, or anxiety, or uncertainty, or when you think about performance. And you're not really prepared, and you go into something, you know what the outcome's going to be. Come on. If you don't study for a test, you don't even know what's on the test. You're going to go in and take a test. What, you think you're going to get an A? No, you know you're going to fail it because you didn't prepare. And you get what you deserve, in my opinion. And you accepted that you could go in unprepared, and that's now going to have an outcome, and the outcome's going to probably not be something that you want. Right. So that's another area is like, why do people get hooked up with substances? And then a whole bunch of, you know, right now, my editor on the book is talking about, okay, let's have like a workbook for kids, like to ask kids like questions, like to themselves, you know, I mean, like, you know, have you done everything possible to prepare for this? Right. And there's a whole bunch of boxes to check off there, physiologically, psychologically, and so forth. Do you have a positive outlook? You guys, I don't know, you maybe if you've seen anything I've done on affirmations. Affirmations are the more you talk about, write about, and think about something, the more you increase the chance of that thing happening. And that comes from a guy that was a three-position shooter for USA. He was an Olympic gold medalist. But before he was Olympic gold medalist, he was Olympic silver medalist. And he decided, I don't want to end my career being an Olympic silver medalist. So he went back to work for another 4 years. A guy named Landy Basham, we brought him in to talk when I was national coach in biathlon, cross-country skiing and shooting. And he said, I just didn't want to be a silver medalist. I want to be a gold medalist. So I signed up for another 4 years, and he went back to the Olympics, and he shot the first perfect score ever shot, meaning every single shot was a bullseye, and no one had ever done it before. And he did it. The only bad part was that the person he was competing against also shot the second perfect score ever shot. And that was the person that won the previous Olympics, got the gold medal that he wanted 4 years earlier. So it goes to a shootout, and you shoot one hand load one at a time. You shoot a standing prone and kneeling. And he, this went on and on and on. An X is a bullseye, another X. The other person that gets an X, you get an X, 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 more and more bullets, more and more shots, above and beyond anything that had ever been done in the sport. Finally, he makes the shot, the opponent misses, and he finally gets his gold medal. And now the other person is a silver medalist. And they ask him after, what was going through your mind when you were in the shootout and the gold medal was up for grabs and you had now been training and had done all that work to overcome what you didn't want to happen last time? And he said, I just remembered what I wrote in my training log every day when I would get done shooting. And these guys are meticulous. And he brought one of his training logs and he wrote on the bottom of every page, I will be Olympic champion. Nice. Every day for 4 years, he wrote that at the bottom of the page. And these guys keep data on light. Or so the sun shining, where's the sun? Is there a breeze? What's the humidity? All these things affect, you know, ballistics. So he brings up one of his training logs and he puts it there, great big thick book with all of that data, all those charts and sheets and how many hits and where his misses were. And on the bottom of every page, I will be Olympic champion. And, you know, so, I mean, that's the stories that you write the stuff down, you talk about it, you think about it and that's not unhealthy.
No.
That's healthy. You know, that's as healthy as it gets, because it helps you eventually get to a point where you believe it so much that when you go to do it, that's going to be part of the reason that helps you be able to do it. So, anyway,
I agree, John. I think that story is actually a great way for us to just end this conversation. The book sounds amazing. Can you give us a teaser? Is it coming out anytime soon, or when can we expect it?
No, I've got my coach that wrote all of Bowerman's books for track and field, Bill, you know, the guy that started Nike, and he wrote Bowerman's biography and his coaching manuals. He gave me information. We got to get a publisher next. Cool. But I mean, there's nothing like this out there.